Green. Thanks for coming. This is March 15th, and we're at the Old Church House with Herb Green doing an oral interview for the Balkley Valley Museum. And Herb, you gave me a yellow piece of paper here with for the deer coloring or?
Yeah, whatever. It's just ones that I thought were possible, eh?
And what is that? We'll get
that's
into that.
Okay, just.
Yeah. Okay, so I would like to know, you came to the Valley in 1980?
Yes,
and
I was transferred here from Manning Park.
From Manning Park, and what made you want to come to Smithers?
I was sent here to solve some problems, and I became the regional director here, which includes the area from Tweedsmuir Park to Atlin Park, and the parks on the Queen Charlotte, and east to almost Prince George.
Okay.
Including Stone Mountain and Edziza, Spatizi, Atlin. Some of the finest places in BC with these people in there and the most mosquitoes.
Yeah. What month did you come here? Did you move?
I was here May 1980.
In May 1980. And so you said you came up here to solve some problems. Is
yes.
that anything you want to talk about?
It was in conjunction with the problems of one of the problems was in related to the Greenpeace disturbances in Spatizi Park. And also there were some fairly serious problems related to the falling of problem timber in the Lake Elts campground.
Oh.
They were being taken out because of danger, and there was upset people questioning whether or not it was needed.
Right.
And so I resolved those problems.
Okay. Oh, good. Yeah. And so I have, on your bibliography, you said that you were a ranger. And is when you moved to Smithers, what was your position then?
Here as the regional director, but on the other hand, I did a lot of the field work, and I possessed the authority underneath the Park Act as a park ranger, a conservation officer, as they call them now, but it was a game warden. I had the authority to enforce the Motor Vehicle Act and the Forest Act in the parks, like.
Right. And so so I'm going to just go back to and ask you about, like, when you moved up here, was it strictly for the job, or had you come up ahead of time and checked out the valley before you accepted?
No, I was transferred here.
Okay.
And it was anticipated I'd be here at the time I'd done troubleshooting elsewhere, and was expected that I'd be here for a few months. And
right. And how long were you here before you retired in 88, was it?
Yes, my final day was the end of June in 1987, I think.
87, okay.
And I phoned my boss in Victoria and got him out of a meeting. And when he come on there, I just sung the song, "You Can Take This Job," and stuff. I don't work here anymore.
Yeah. Oh, that's right, because Elner, I see too, she was here. She was your kind of a support through the time when you worked with parks. And
well, in a lot of the areas where we were in relatively small we were in remote areas when I was absent, and there was some kind of a necessity, people coming, whether it was just for information or for some form of emergency, a lot of times she acted with in the form of not going out, but in relaying information and coordinating things. Yeah.
Did she ever have to do that in Smithers, or was the office big enough?
Not so
here?
Much here, because it was one of the first times that we lived away from the job in the big areas, the big parks, and that we lived right in the parks.
Right, right.
Areas like Mount Robson, and that is a combination of problems off the highway and railroad, and then consequent what was going on, and a lot of the activities were related to Kenny Lake and the mountaineering in there. And it was because of that it made things complex, and you never knew what was coming.
How about here in your area, in the what is it officially called, your area here? Because it's quite large.
This is the Skeena.
The Skeena?
Yeah.
Yeah. So did you see many changes in the 8 years or seven that you were here?
Oh, sure. Access has changed drastically with regard to Highway 37.
Okay.
Where you could drive up through there. For instance, a road trip to Atlin was somewhere around 15 road hours.
Right. Okay.
And a trip to Bella Coola was very close to the same.
Right.
You know, we would utilize aircraft, but lots of times you, because of meetings and people that you had to see in different situations along the way, you didn't fly unless it was an emergency. You planned your trip and, you know, went to the various campgrounds and operations, and in a lot of cases meeting and dealing with guide outfitters that had problems, or education, or liaison with other agencies.
Right. So did you get down to Bella Coola very often?
During the time that I was here, periodically it was I'd get down, but I spent the summer of 1956 on reconnaissance of the new portion of the area that was proposed to have the area a park down there. Before that time, there was the parkland took in the lake system south of Burns Lake. And when the flooding came, then they decided that they'd move the boundaries and extend it for compensation. So we were in there doing a reconnaissance, Ralph Ritzy and I. And then in the fall, he left and I stayed and sort of met the people that were coming and going in the valley, plus the hunters that were there, mostly grizzly bear hunters.
Okay.
And I also was trying to get a base number of the amount of grizzly bear that were in there. And then I went back there in 1957 when I was married, and we spent the whole season there, and I stayed. I was alone doing the travel in the park, and then the fall I went back and did more intensive work with the grizzly bear.
Okay.
And then we went back there again in 1963 for a period.
So did you said like you do road access into Bella Coola?
It just had come into Bella Coola the year before. I think it was 55 that they got the punched the road in.
Okay. So back then you weren't in the Skeena.
No, I was assistant ranger out of Wellsgray Park.
Wellsgray, oh, I see, okay.
During that period, it wasn't until 65 that I went to Mount Robson as the park ranger.
Okay. Do you have, do do I have access to a map of the Skeena Parks District? That
I don't really know, but I could draw a circle.
Yeah, I'd like that. Yeah.
The in between there, then I was in Mount Robson while the road was, the highway was being punched in. Because the first time that there'd been any liaison in regards between highways and the parks. And they had a designated area to do their work on any deviations of that, like borrow pits or gravel pits or waste areas, etc. They had to get permission, and they got the permission from me for those things.
Okay.
And so consequently, I had quite a bit of liaison with the contractors and Department of Highways at the time. And it was, you never knew what was next.
Yeah.
And, you know, I supposedly had this job, but in most of the cases, I was in the bush as much as I could be. I would work out on to different parts of it, eh?
Okay.
For instance, like in the wintertime when things were a little more slack, I would have a report come in from CN each day, mm-hmm. early in the morning about any accidents with animals overnight, and I would go to whatever location it was and make sure that animal was dead.
Right. Yeah.
Because a lot of them, when the collisions, you know, they get broken up, but they're still alive.
And yeah. So you had a lot of times with to put animals down. And
well, that was just part of it. It's not a very happy thing.
Yeah. So, Herb, you did the reflector project here in the Skeena.
Yeah, it's a volunteer.
Yeah. Okay. And that. That was out of the parks mandate.
No.
Was it in the
parks? No, parks didn't have anything to do with it. It was post working for it. It was after I retired. The organization here called Wildlife for the Future, which consists of the Bulky Rod and Gun Club, the Guide Outfitters, and some interested individuals who weren't affiliated with an organization. We, at that time, were attempting to see if there was a way to minimize the amount of collisions between animals, vehicles, and trains. And we put our heads together and researched a bit. And that's when we come across that reflector system, and we got information on it, and we decided to put in some test areas. So we contacted the company, and we got enough reflectors for 5 kilometers on the highway. And at that time, if you remember the Hungry Hill, the timber come right up to the road.
Right.
And it was a major crossing right from the bottom of the hill right up over to the existing farms beyond there, eh?
Yeah.
And lots of collisions with animals through that block. And we put up roughly 5 kilometers there to the specs provided by the company. And then we also, in an effort to try to understand what took place on the railroad, we put up I can't remember now, it was 5 or 10, but it was somewhere between the two. I'd find it somewhere in the world, but anyway, we had a section in there that was along the railroad that we placed the reflectors in the setup that they had. And all of that work was done by the volunteers, plus some assistance from CN and transport of materials, etc., like the posts and what have you, to take them into the area. And once they were in there, I would go every 10 days and walk that area to see what collisions were there. The railroad would record them and report, but I would physically walk the track.
Yeah, 10 kilometers roughly each way.
No, so. I can't remember what it was. Ten. Anyway, it was more than five, I know that. Anyway, you ended down there by that golf course, you know, beyond the hill, and it started halfway to Houston, down over the bank.
Yeah.
So I'd go and walk it back and forth and see what had been hit.
And what were the results? Do you know how?
Well, what we could say there in that particular area, there was less animals killed on the reflector area than were killed on the highway that had no protection on the adjacent one, eh?
Okay.
And with the amount of manpower and resources we had, that was about all we could say. And the same thing in the section up on Hungry Hill. So the decision was then that we've gone this far. Highways were prepared to assist, and we one way or the other, initiated a program and put up in a lot of the areas within the Skeena that were chronic places where animals were killed. And there was no follow-up other than the records of highways, etc. But there was a general feeling that it made the area safer. But the simple business of it, that there's always going to be collisions between animals and people. And in a lot of cases, what happens is that with a group of animals, one will be going across the road, people will see it, and they feel that the animals are gone, and they're maintaining their speed, and out will come the calf or cow or one falling on the scent, and then you'll have your collision. But overall, it was felt that there was quite an abatement of collisions, and subsequent to that, there's been reflectors put up in quite a few miles up here.
Yeah.
And we were out of the picture then.
Oh, so
this was multi-year, but we're out of the, and some, but like we put up some, like we put up probably 30 miles as volunteers along the highway.
Yeah.
Though we did get a little bit of money, and we're able to hire a few young guys. And I usually worked as the foreman, and we got it. The highway guy would mark the intervals, and I'd look after materials and stuff and work too. But we had some young guys there that were gung-ho, and we got lots done.
Yeah, really awesome. So, and then also, Herb, you were involved with the deer tagging.
Yep.
And what was the purpose of that? And
well, there was a feeling here that there was not very much known. In fact, there's nothing known about what went on with the deer population in the valley. And this area is interesting because it doesn't only have mule deer. It has white-tailed deer. It has the coastal blacktail. To, you know, that has a completely black a subspecies there. Okay. And what we decided to do, that we would access the animals, well, it was basically Rod and Gun Club, but we're still Wildlife for the Future, because the Wildlife for the Future got some seed money together through fundraisings. And matter of fact, they still are doing works.
Oh, really?
Well, for the future, okay. With the token amount of money, eh?
Yeah.
And I think today, Ron Fleming and Dave Hooper are still involved with that. And I've been out of the picture for quite a while because of my family problem.
Yeah. So here, what year, I'm going to go back to the reflectors and the deer tagging. Do you know what year that was, or years, that it started, the reflector project?
I don't know. A lot of those pictures, they're multi-year, eh?
Yeah. I know. I remember being, you know, helping out with the...
I know, and the deer... When we started the deer project, Keith Hooper's wife.
Oh, Tracy.
Tracy, she is the rod and gun president at that time. And we got out a working crew and volunteers, and we put out a number of traps that we had a trap that... It's in its record, there'd been very few animals injured in it, seriously injured. And so this particular trap, we put out some at Harold Curl's place and some up at Gord Curl's place. And we'd patrol them morning every day.
Yeah.
And... out there, then we would put radio collars through we purchased some radio collars, and we put radio collars on the does, and we ear tagged and the does, and we also ear tagged any bucks we got. And with the buck, we just put on a nylon sleeve because you can't very well mark them with a collar because their neck swells so big in the fall that could injure them, eh? But we ran that program for about 3 years. And along with it, we had from our bunnies and the... we had the enough money that we could pay gas for about three pilots who had their private planes, and they'd go out and check where those deer were at intervals.
They had the, what do you call that, tracking?
Yeah.
Yeah,
equipment. And with that, we found that deer... range from these farms, from those areas, as far as up to the headwaters of the Maurice and over towards Uta Lake, past the airport in Burns Lake. And, you know, you think, why? That's up the watershed, eh? And we had some up north in Nakitwa.
Really? Wow.
And those guys came from right here. Because we had some real successful trapping on the end of the ridge there by Call Lake.
Oh, yeah.
And those animals were going out. And the thing that was very interesting about it is that they had an affinity for those farms. And see, like up at the upper clear... Kerr place, there could be 60 to 80 deer there feeding in the morning, eh? And those deer disperse so far out during the summer, and they return to those farms. There was never known to have a deer from Gordon Kerr's at the other Kerr's.
Oh.
We never knew of a deer tagged on this ridge up here by town that it was at any of those farms. At the same time, a lady was feeding some deer just east of Telqua, and she never seen one of our tagged animals.
Oh, that's amazing.
And with all those ones ranging out, we only got one whitetail, and that particular whitetail was never known to be more than 7 miles from Kerr Farm.
Oh, be darned. Did they ever interbreed?
Oh, sure.
They did.
That all happens all the time.
Yeah, did you ever get one in your trap that had
interbred? Oh, sure, we tagged them. And the interbred, you know, of course, is there's markings on them that you can tell the interbred.
Yeah.
They have a variation of the markings on them.
Did you ever have any kind of unusual characters in the traps? Like,
oh, yeah. Yeah, I seen some. I think one of the things with it, we found that we tried to immobilize them by putting ropes onto their feet and, you know, cowboy style.
Yeah.
And after a bit, we found it was just a waste of our time and stress for the animal. Eh? And what we decided to do is we'd rig it up, and usually me, I'd just go into the trap and overpower them. Eh? By getting up onto their shoulders and pulling on a leg, you can trip them easy. Eh?
Yeah.
And then we'd drag them out and use the technique where somebody put a coat over the animal's head. And then over the eyes, we even devised one that we could put on easy.
Yeah.
That didn't interfere with putting the collar on or the tags. And quite often, you remember Belinda?
Yeah.
Quite often, she was just a nice, friendly lady, and she would feel sorry for them and be holding them there and talking nice to them. And one of the deals with it, that when you have them mobilized, is that working on them, then when it's time to free them, you everybody free, everything is there. We got all the data. Have we recorded it? Have we turned on the radio? As you've been fairly thorough at that. And then everybody's ready, yep, and step back. And in this particular case, Belinda had not gone, she'd gone the wrong direction. When the deer jumped, it hit her and knocked her down, and it was a strider across and was beating the tar out of the stove in front and behind. And then it made a couple of three. By the time we were trying to shoo it away or drive it, the deer had reacted and it started jumping up this pile of those round bales and up over the pile and was gone. And I said, "You all right?" "Oh, yeah." "So I'm all right. I'm all right." Then after a while, they found out her shirt was tied and ripped, and oh, she had multi bruises on her that she didn't show to anybody.
She's stoic, though. Yeah. Hey, I remember there was a Barney, too, at one of the deer that...
Oh, yeah, that one deer there, we were Carr's place, not Carr's... excuse me, I've got Cars on my mind now. Gordon Kerr. At Kerr's place, at the lower place, and they process their grain there through a fan, and the fan will be bits of grain out there, like dust on the snow, and the deer will come to feed on that.
Oh, yeah.
And anyway, this Barney, he is a yearling, and he was there every night. And for several nights, we caught him. One night he'd be in one side, next night he'd be on the other.
In the traps?
Yeah. And And we caught him probably 7 or 8 times.
Wow.
And over a period of time, and he ultimately was killed by a car on the road near Quick.
Oh, okay.
That was a couple of years later.
Okay.
But it because he's such a nice cop, after a while, he'd just lay there till come up and release him. He yeah. became tame, eh?
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, when you consider that those animals, sometime through the year, were 60, 70 miles away from here, or pretty 90 kilometers, as they call them now.
Yeah.
And the bulk of them returned to that point unless they had a mortality. And because of the type of radios they had, of course, a mortality was would be reported as soon as they aren't moved.
Right.
They put out a dead sound, and the guys flying the airplane could pick them up. And periodically, some of us would go with a listening device and trying to locate and see whether, you know, locate some of the deer and or if some were dead here.
Yeah.
And, you know, we didn't have the scope of some of the surveys that go on today with the satellite. And, but later on, the Wildlife for Future bought, I think, 2 or 3 of the ones that tied in with the satellite, you know, where they can record the daily move.
Okay.
And those ones were put on elk out here.
So did, were you out involved in any of the elk surveys and stuff?
Well, been out on some of the flights, and I was also involved in that transport of the male caribou onto the caribou were being caught up way up towards the Sussex. And so we were bringing them in on top of the Telqua there.
Right.
They'd fly them in with the helicopter and release them there, eh?
Do you know any you know data now about how the caribou are doing out there?
I don't know anything. Update. All I hear is I'm not out in the bush.
Yeah, yeah. And then, like, what other have you had other wildlife experiences or encounters, like with the goats or the grizzlies or the black bear, that stand out in your mind at all?
Well, Most of course, you can't work around the parks without periodically having a bear problem. And usually it's in the early days, you know, most of the, in where there was camps or campgrounds, there was always a garbage pit.
Right.
And in those days, a lot of cases that just depended on who did it and whatever. It could be a pit in the ground. It could be, most of it was a steep hill that they could back a vehicle up to it.
Yeah.
And throw the stuff over, and there'd be bear coming and going there. And as long as they're nocturnal and not coming in around, everybody got by. But usually the bear become habituated, and the mild ones and the fearful ones, they were all nocturnal, and the other guys, if they become aggressive or start coming in around the camp, or they'd ultimately be shot.
Right. So now, on your list here, you have also Greenpeace. Did you have, other than when you first came?
What the situation was regarding Greenpeace was there was a protest against the trophy hunting that they had organized, eh? And there was guide outfitters all over the province and all over, actually, North America, were guide outfitters. And they zoomed in on the operation at Spateasy, because Spateasy's always had a an attraction, a feeling that this is the outstanding wildlife area in the province, eh? And there's, because it's in a Class A park, there's also the feeling, why is hunting not as permitted? Well, it's one of the bona fide recreations that's considered acceptable within the parks. Mm-hmm. If it's done underneath a reasonable and safe way. Mm-hmm. And in that deal, they had come in and tried to block some of the hunting parties up in the forest there. And unfortunately, you know, what they're doing is looking for confirmation. What they're looking for is people react or overreacting to make them look bad and
right.
We look good. Anyway, when my particular end of it was that the guide outfitters here were being impacted by it. Plus, there was also almost insult, you know, that we are legitimate businessmen, and most of them, they love what they're doing. And here these unknowns are in criticizing it. And part of it was being agitated from a group within the valley. And of course, it's like any match that you throw in the gasoline, it expands. So there's people from a great area, select people. Some of them were taken, and they established at Coalfish Lake, where this, the old Tommy Walker camp there that's open for anybody who wants to go and stay there.
Okay.
In those days, I don't know now whether they have any kind of reservation system or that. I'm not aware. But in those days, you could come and stay. And there was lots of places you could bunk. Anyway, they had a group there, and they were harassing the closest camps that and trying to follow the pack horses out into the bush and this kind of stuff. And it was bad, you know. Yeah. And there was legal aspects to it, and trying to resolve it, the problem. Anyway, I didn't know much about these kind of guys, so I thought, well, I'd be dealing with a few interesting things, like the motorcycle gangs on the lower mainland around the campsite. In my mind, I equated these fellas sort of to the same.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I'm going to go up there. So I went up and got a plane and got flown in, and I was in my bush clothes, and I camped at Coalfish Lake. Pretty soon I was cooking meals with them and washing dishes. And
with the Greenpeace?
Sure. They did. And I wasn't, as a park guy, I was a visitor. And it was really interesting. These are naive good people.
Right.
Most of them super educated from diverse areas. They're telling how they deal and try to cause people to overreact. And they were given some demonstrations there that they say that they got somebody and he was their target.
Yeah.
A couple of them would come in on them. They'd start asking questions. And they were asking questions in such a way that trying to get this person to overreact and almost insulting type of questions. Eh? And they're smart people. Yeah. And on the other hand, in order that they didn't make themselves look poor, they had a system that if I'm the one who's questioning the guide outfitter and I'm starting to lose mine, there's a certain key word they'd say, and that meant for me to shut up.
Oh.
And I'd shut up, and the other one would come in and, you know, resolve the position. But they're organized people, and the one fellow there, he'd been out on a number of protests at places, and he worked on a deal that they had a call out. And if they needed a guy to go to wherever, some of them would drop the stuff and go. Could be international, eh?
Okay.
And I think it's back to this, the modern world where people travel long distance in the media. And from my time to now, it's completely different because everywhere you go, there's somebody with a camera.
Yeah.
And records whatever the situation is, and where in those days it was, and we'd set up kind of a plan of how to get it, to resolve the problem peacefully and legally remove them, the protesters, say, because it's, unless you're committing a crime, you're innocent.
Yeah.
How, what can you do?
So how did it have to end up?
The thing happened that eventually a number of them come into one of the remote camps, and there is some violence, and supposedly a few of them got pounded around a bit, and it was resolved in a trial here in town and minor fines. And some things that were comical in their way, such as the fellow trying to identify the guy who beat him up. And the fellow he thought was had beat him up was one of the Britain boys, eh?
Okay.
So the two Britons were in there. The only way I could ever identify those guys when they're close together was by the color of the dog of the guy, because one always had a black dog, the other had brown dogs. But the end result of it was that within the Game Act came a thing that no one can harass legally a legal hunter.
Okay.
It's illegal to protest or to interfere with the legal hunter.
With a legal hunter, yeah.
So that didn't solve everybody's problem, but it comes back down to the deal that somewhere it's got to be reasonable, and it's reasonable to allow the hunting and bona fide recreation within areas as long as it doesn't interfere with other aspects, eh?
Right.
You know, it's the same thing with snowmobiles now and all-terrain vehicles and llamas for packing. And all of them become problems in one form or another, and has to be set up to maintain certain atmospheres, eh?
Yeah.
You know, cripes. In some of the national parks, they won't allow you to use Vibram-soled shoes.
Oh.
It's too much wear on
them. Yeah.
But that's human.
Yeah.
And you know, what we're talking about here is to talk to me about these things that happened all around.
Yeah.
That's part and parcel of a long period of time.
Yeah.
And the actual situation in Smithers during the time that I was here as a government official, it was more, a lot of those areas were at the pioneering level and acquisition of lands, etc. And some of the things where there were interesting situation trying to resolve them was such things as visitation to Anthony Island, which is has become a historical site in the province. Eh?
Which one's that?
It's the south end of the Queen Charlotte Island. Okay. Off, but still got a lot of poles standing there and different deals. We built a, from salvage material, we built a replica of a native type structure, put accommodation on there, and we had a patrolman on there during the summer. And it was taken over, of course, by the national parks and the native folk over there.
Yeah.
And we were completely out of the picture on the Charlottes, except for Nike Park. And it's, you know, all those areas have unique problem, and they also are outstanding areas to go to.
Yeah.
As far as the most outstanding area away from here is Mount Isa, and few people know of it, or it's sort of heard of, but it's not an area where there's a great amount of visitation. But it's an area where the north part of it is a great volcanic area and lava flows that are still not growth coming back on them. And the southern part of it, some of the most outstanding scenery in the province associated with colored rocks from the chemicals in the rocks causing a multicolored in the lava flows there.
Yeah, is that the Rainbow Range?
No.
No?
No, the Rainbow's in, Rainbow Mountains are in
Tweedsmuir.
North of near the Dean River.
Oh, yeah. Herb, when I can go at the museum and go on their old copies of the newspapers up until, I think there's copies until a couple years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Do you mind if I pull up as many of the articles? Because quite a few articles with you involved in them.
Oh, yeah.
That would be for...
I don't think there's any secrets there.
Yeah. Yeah. So I probably will do that. I'll go in, you know, like Wednesday or Thursday maybe. And
you know, there's two sides to this kind of stuff. You know, there's always the serious sides and the ones that are interesting. And also there's lots of humor to it.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the humor, now, like you played with a Just for Fun band, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and who was in that band?
At the time there was the two, Joy and Peter Eklibby, Roy Chick, John Kohler, Ron Berger, and myself.
Yeah. Yeah, and you played where? How far? Like you played in the valley, but
yeah, most of it was sort of arranged visitations to the seniors' places, and once in a while the farmers' market and this kind of stuff. But it was mostly with that, or you know, now and then we were invited to some family functions and that, but. It wasn't professional by any means.
It was fun. So you were also a Canadian Ranger. Did you do that after you moved to the Valley at all?
Yes.
And what did that involve?
You volunteer. It's a federal program of milita. Basically, the people are supposed to have bush backgrounds and. In the case of emergencies, federal emergencies, that these would be their key people to know the area and key people to be the information for the government or the army or safety people. And the detachments are spread along the coast of British Columbia, all the way through the Arctic and Canada, in lots of cases. Their presence up north in the Arctic is, that's really Canada's reaffirming that the Arctic is part of Canada, not no man's land.
Yeah.
And you see often on something shown that's from the north, you see the guys in their red outfits or carrying their old .303 British rifles, and that's them there.
That's the Rangers.
Yeah.
Did how long were you with the Rangers after you retired?
It was several years. Yeah. I had the rank of a master corporal. I could have had better, but I couldn't assume it with the stuff that I did.
Okay. And so, did the Rangers ever, put on community events or anything like that?
Well, they're pretty low-key.
Okay.
And like any military deal, there's a certain selection and discipline within the group, and access to knowledge, eh?
Right.
I think they should have more involvement with search and rescue and that kind of stuff. But, you know, in a lot of cases, it almost seems like it's the same people, but underneath different setups.
Yeah.
It's the same with search and rescue. It's the I've always been involved in a lot of in the areas that I'm in, involved in searches and recoveries, etc. And part of that was professionally because of the position I had.
So that it was in the 8 years here that you were with Parks, did you do
Yeah,
some?
With them, I wasn't, of course, as much out in that kind of time because of the, I would go, I registered with them, but normally I'd go as a tracker.
Yeah. Yeah. What would you say would be, you know, one of the, where you were tracking here in the valley for, you know, was it like, did you go out on searches for mushroom pickers or for?
I went out a bit to the mushroom pickers, but I have no respect for them.
Okay.
I think that I feel that anyone who goes into the bush underneath those circumstances, they should be capable of getting themselves out of the bush and have a safety plan to back them up.
Yeah.
You know, that's easy to say, but I think that in most of the cases, you know, the people that go out there that are go out often, they've got that capability, but there's always the ones who go out that are not equipped with any kind of locator or maps or knowledge of compass or terrain.
Yeah.
And it's hard to respect people like that.
Yeah, yeah. And they should be going out two by two anyhow, yeah. In case something happens. So you were with Search and Rescue.
Yeah.
As a tracker. Ground search and rescue. Yeah. Did you ever work together with air search?
Well, only in the training.
Yeah.
And, you know, at that time we had the communications were pretty limited.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I remember it too from. we did UTM and you guys did the other.
Yeah, to me, I felt that the system has good qualities and lots of good people, but I felt that the people in charge locally didn't have any respect for the a tracker.
Okay.
From the aspect that in lots of cases, if you can get two or three, or even one or two or three people to make a sweep during the before any area is used, tramped up, etc.
Right.
They can get the picture quicker than you can when suddenly you come into a situation where there's been lots of activity. Eh?
Yeah. Yeah.
You want to hear a little story about that?
Absolutely. We got lots of stories.
Okay. We're stand by. We need you. We're getting two more guys Clive Nunn and Bob Pierce from Burns Lake, myself. I'm being picked, flown out of here to Burns Lake. We pick those guys up. We fly straight to the Queen Charlotte's. We're in a helicopter. We're flying to the North Beach. The police figure that there's been foul play. Two German tourists who were supposed to be on the ferry the night before didn't get on the ferry. Their car was found with the doors open just off the beach on the road to Toe Hill.
Yeah.
Doors open. Nobody around. They're missing.
Yeah.
RCMP say they want assistance with some people to come and some of the trackers. So here we arrive at this vehicle, and there's already four or five vehicles parked there. There's sandy type road, and there's tracks pointed every different direction. People have been up to the back and forth to that vehicle probably 40 or 50 times. People have been looking in the doors, etc. And understandable.
Yeah.
The people that found it, then the police, then the people that were there waiting, and Elka. And here they are sort of waiting for these guys to come. And when we come in sight, I said to them, all we can do is do like the dogs, you know, go up and sniff all the tires and everything, because I don't think there's too much we can do here.
Yeah.
Anyway, we looked the thing over, and then we started to go out into the bush, see if we could pick anything up that was out. And the moss over there is so thick, you know, an elephant could walk on it and you couldn't follow him. Eh?
Wow.
It just springed. So here we back in the bush, about 70 feet, 80 feet. Here's a big pile of toilet paper, and the guy had a spurt of diarrhea.
Oh.
And here about 15 feet away is another pile. And here's another one, or another one. And the guys are gone. And we're looking all around. Couldn't find any tracks. And then we followed some more toilet paper over here. And the guys were just missing. And we're in there circling around trying to see what we could find. They had left their vehicle going into the bush. All you got to do is listen a minute and you hear the beat of the surf on the beach out there. Thump, thump, thump. Yeah. Nobody could get lost. Eh?
Yeah.
They went from there all the way across the from the central part of the park all the way to the east coast, and were found about the time that we were looking for them in there.
Oh, my goodness.
They'd gone about 12 miles through the bush to the east and left their vehicle. They got lost. It wasn't 150 yards away from their truck.
Oh, Lord. So did they spend the night out in the bush?
Sure.
Huh.
Well, this had been, the vehicle had been there overnight before the police were on it. Then we were there after the second night.
Wow.
We expect to find a dead man. Yeah. We found the sign all right.
Yeah.
But we'd have never followed him anywhere. And, you know, that's stupid stuff.
Yeah. 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 Do you have any other stories like that from searches or wildlife?
Well, remember finding us. In this area here, yes, we've been involved in a search for a man at Telqua. That he had Alzheimer's and got himself mixed up. And it was kind of interesting because we're given, he used to jog along 4 or 5 kilometers along the lake, and he just disappeared. And there was a major search started out, and this, and we were told to be at daylight at a certain location. I misunderstood it as where that creek runs out from Tai Lake. I thought that was the rendezvous spot, and I got dropped there before daybreak. And then the other two people on my tracking team came and seen me. So the three of us are waiting. And I had to relieve myself. So I walked in the trail a little ways there. There was a bit of a puddle. And on the side of the trouble, there's a track. Right? So we were out there waiting. Long come the fellow in charge of the group. And he said, "What are you doing here?" And said, "Well, we're, you know, wasn't this where?" "No, no, you're supposed to be up here about another 8 kilometers or so." I said, "Have you got the diagram of the boot?" And he did. And that's normally the first thing you do is try to identify the foot. And I said, "Well, he's in here. I see half his track." So we went in there, and he had, poor guy, he'd been in there for probably 24 hours, and mosquitoes thicker than heck.
Yeah. I was on that search, but we had this sort of a similar problem to you. There were so many ground search people out that it was hard to.
Well, you're doing it from the air.
From the air, yeah.
Well, I think that's back to the deal that's sort of solved now because of. More people have communication, eh?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the cell phones and that are great things, but, you know, when you look at that constant problem down the coast there with people calling for search and rescues in places, all they have to do is think a little bit,
right.
Turn around and follow their track back.
Back, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And here just 2 nights ago, they put a... that big helicopter out searching for 2 hikers lost on Mount Seymour. The thousands of dollars to get those guys and long line them up under the bush where they're capable of coming out, eh?
Yeah.
A guy going in there on their tracks, and well, it's pretty hard down there to follow tracks too. I've been on searches on Seymour, and it's very difficult because of so many people.
Right. Yeah.
And it's so complex now. You know, like the snowmobilers. You go in an area where they're snowmobiling, they're going every which way with the track.
Yeah.
It's.
Did you ever do a snowmobile or like a winter search?
Yeah.
In the Babines? Or?
No, actually, I was in area down the below Burns Lake. It was. That was one of those typical ones, go in and the machine breaks down and they didn't come out. Eh?
Oh, yeah.
But those things are minor.
Yeah. So I'm just, you know, wondering if you have any other comments about, like, the time that you've been here in the valley?
Well, I think Smithers is a good place to live. I think it's an area where... without a doubt, there's an opportunity for a lot of people to have employment, but it's back to the other deal that the people with skills and knowledge still have the greatest opportunity here.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing how many people are employed by the railroad.
Yeah, you know,
it's always considered that the mill and the bush is the big one, but it's nothing in proportion to the amount of people involved with the railroad.
Yeah, and it's getting more and more all the time, the train traffic to Prince Rupert.
Yeah, it's a new, it'll become double track without a doubt, and, you know, the whole thing. But, you know, those are good, solid payrolls that are part of parcel and also a static people who comes in and establishes themselves, the families and that.
Yeah.
You know, and the bush guys are now, there's less and less people working in the bush and producing more timber per day.
The boys and their toys.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, though that's true. And you were doing with the Rod and Gun Club.
Yep.
Yeah. When did you start right away with the Rod and Gun Club and you first moved here in 80?
Yeah, I always felt that they're a good organization, and basically I was more interested in the firearms and shooting.
And you were teaching.
Yeah, I taught survival, and also I was qualified to instruct firearms, use of firearms, and I was a hunter training. Yeah. I was qualified to do that.
Was that the core?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was amongst some of the first in BC, but I got qualified when I was at Fort St. John.
Okay. Good.
We're working out of Fort St. John up the Alaska Highway was my district. Those areas like the Muncho and Lake Els, or not Lake Els, Liard Hot Springs and Boya Lake and Mezziad and interesting places.
Yeah. So the Skeena part, do you think is... When you've been at like Manning and Tweedsmuir, this is like kind of a gold standard too, isn't it? The Skeena Park system.
Well, within the actual equipment that they put in campgrounds and that, they're pretty well standard because of the use, eh?
Oh,
and the actual campground as it is a very desirable system to have, but in lots of cases it's where the original campsites were put in, they should really become private enterprise.
Well, they should be.
Yep.
How come?
For the simple business of if there can be money made and the service provided by industry, it's a lot better than to use the public dollar in areas where the access and knowledge, etc., of these large areas that are provincial park. So those scarce dollars should be spent in those areas. And when you consider that now 14% of the province is in the protected zones, those areas, you know, it's just like the road into the to Babin here. How many people use that little trail, eh?
Yeah.
You know, it's a nice little operation. And you know, those backed up with things like the Twin Falls and now these small areas like the access at Lunan Road. Those are vital to recreation of the people in the area.
Yeah.
Access to that river. you know, that's a good way to spend money.
So how would private enterprise
for the simple thing that if you have that land and you can operate a campground in it and upgrade it to the acceptable level, more people will those places look at the demand for them.
Yeah.
You know, here they are getting reservations for the whole summer and crowding the phones, etc.
Yeah.
Because of it's a scarce commodity. And, you know, the problem to for most people to make a living out of that, you know, like the companies that they're basically a 73-day season.
Right.
Is their tourist season. Eh?
Yeah.
But the ones that are tied in with the transportation corridors and that, if they have power and access to it, those things can operate at a profit year round.
Okay.
Because it is a commodity that's used over and above the motel, hotel. You know, those are the self-contained groups. And, you know, when you put it into that kind of stuff, it's all just an aspect of human use.
Right.
You know, our for most of us, we probably don't use a park, the facilities in the park for camping and that, because we're more with the activities that we do, we're more attractive to the outdoor activity and the small forest service type camps offer the opportunity that we use.
Yeah. There's a whole different kind of.
Yeah, and it's great that it can be all different.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's places where the Cypresses, the Seymours, the Mannings and that, you know, they're crowded.
Right. Yeah.
There's a reservation system on the Barron Lake to go canoeing, of all things, eh? Yeah. With all the rivers and lakes. There's a reservation system to go into Berg Lake in Mount Seymour, or pardon me, Mount Robson. Yeah. And you think, what the heck? You know, that's a wild area. Well, it's wild, but it's used to a reasonable capacity, eh?
Yeah. So, and do you think in the in those like areas in the parks and that it should stay kind of isolated? Like no, like I can remember hiking with somebody and saying, I would love for there to be a gift store here.
Yeah. Well, I think that comes back down to people will use a needed facility.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's just like the pit toilets that many places where there's lots of use, they're almost offensive, eh, to use them. But there's still what can you put in there at a reasonable cost and maintain it, eh?
Right, yeah.
And it's obvious that if these situations like we're coping with right now, that still those areas that are associated close to the big populations, they just attract people.
Yeah.
You see the lineups of people at Mount Seymour and that kind of stuff. Eh?
Yeah.
I spent some time there and early 50s, and I thought there were crowds, but it's certainly a different thing now. Yeah.
Hey, I just occurred to me, I know it's probably getting time to take a break, but can you talk a little bit about your trap line that you had and like some of the animals and, you know, the market and things like that?
For the fur industry?
Yeah.
Actually, the fur industry was the reason that Canada was settled.
Right.
Because they were out looking for the hides, eh?
Yeah.
And the competing companies pressed for knowledge of more and more Native people to trade with, to obtain the fur. And over the years, there's still a great number of people of who are legally trapping and handling fur. And fur is another one of these international commodities that depend upon the market. And sometimes you might find that depending upon fashion, Martin will bring you $170. And 3 years later, the average might be $30. Oh, eh? So okay. There's no way that a person could anticipate it. Where like now, which beaver are virtually worthless in the sense of return for your work. The most money that's made now are the people that are controlling beaver.
Okay.
Because of the damage and plugging culverts and all this kind of stuff. So these are complex problems. But on the legal trap line, I think that the number is just not sticking with me right now, but there's several thousand legal trappers in British Columbia who are licensed along with qualified Native bands that trap. And in most cases, the fur that is there are handled in a traditional way that when they're taken, the animal is taken in a humane way. And the type of traps that are used that are probably as humane as you can possibly have them. And the bulk of the animals now are killed, you know, by the device. And the fur that is taken from the line, you own the exclusive use to take okay. the fur off of a designated area. Mm-hmm. You have to pass a training to humanely and legally and do everything to meet the government's requirements. And then you also, each animal you take, you pay a royalty on it, which means that, say, you're selling it for $1, you got to pay the government 10 cents. You know, it doesn't sound like much, but it brings in money in the deal. And, you know, the use, the amount of fur that's used now, there isn't a lot of fur used in fashion of our country. Most of it goes internationally, sold into areas where they have a different culture. Eh?
Okay.
And in Canada, the trim on coats are probably the biggest one, where people have the ruffs around their collars and their parkas. But it's a very interesting activity for people who have that bent.
Yeah.
And you know, for us that got the hunter blood, it's not too hard to get up in the barn and go out there.
You go out in the wilderness, I know. So do you think it was, two years ago that you stopped trapping?
Three years. It was Eleanor started having trouble, say.
Right. So was it still an activity and a kind of a hobby?
It's both, but you know, a lot of it didn't have to do it for the money.
Right, okay, yeah.
And I think in a lot of cases that's still there. But also there are people who make reasonable incomes, but it's coming more and more that the money you're making is of the control of noxious animals. And, with the problems with wolves around the cattle, and there's substantial sums paid to go in and remove the animals that are killing stock, etc. And that's where the money is. Just like you see a guy driving around here, and he's very low key, and he's trapping the animals that are trying to get into all the stores and Super Values and that. There's a trapper going there every week, sometimes twice a week, and they're by the lodge and the old age home.
Oh, yeah.
And nobody even knows that a trapper is working on behalf of safety and the reduction of sickness and the fact that it's removed the potential of mouse droppings in the flower.
Yeah.
And you know, that's a comedy because the traps are there in plain sight.
In the stores?
Oh. You go and look outside of the stores, or like the wholesale over there.
Yeah. Do you ever monitor the traps and stuff?
I don't look after them.
They do that.
You don't interfere with another guy's operation.
Yeah.
That's not right.
Yeah.
Like I've had people up there who we got our game cameras, you know, to come.
Herb, is there anything else that you'd like to comment on before we close our interview session?
It's my world has been complex in its way and simple in the other.
Yeah.
I've always liked to go to work.
Yeah.
And I found that the working for the parks has been extremely interesting because it's so varied from fire. Well, you're responsible for everything that takes place within that area.
Yeah.
And at the same time, most of the cases, you went underneath strict supervision at the level that I worked.
You were the supervisor.
Well, you know, even before I became a supervisor, I wasn't closely supervised.
Yeah.
Most of the time, there's a job to do. It was done.
Yeah, good.
You know, things like spring has come, the trails to Berg Lake have to be open. You got nobody else. Fix up the power saw and out you go, and maybe you're the boss. You're out there bucking the wood, eh?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you how those things can be. I was working at cutting out a great amount of windfall. It was put down on the trail to the Guinea Lake in the Mount Robson, which ultimately is the trail that goes up to Berg Lake, eh? Big timber. Avalanche has come down. It's knocked down probably 40, 60 good-sized trees that span the trail at the edge of the avalanche. Eh? And I'm out there working away, and the snow is still on the ground. And I probably burnt close to a jerry can full of fuel in the last few days, cutting stuff off, throwing it off the trail. A bear comes out of the snow down the hill away, and he stands up looking around there. It's a grizzly bear, so I don't have a rifle, and feeling uneasy, it's time to quit. back, I went to home. When I get out there, message, they wanted to meet me, the Department of Highways, and the engineer wanted to meet me to get an okay to widen a borrow pit that would be the stuff taken out, then a berm put in.
Okay.
They needed my permission as the parks representative. So I'm down at their camp waiting for them. They told me that my message had said they'd been there. And here I've come from that situation up there, walked out probably 2 miles and sweaty and bush clothes, go to the camp, and I'm waiting there. So a big camp, went to the cook shack. That's where, you know, you're going to meet.
Yeah.
They got an office, but the cook shack, you kill the time till they get there. I'm in there having a coffee, and this big guy, he's over there looking at me and looking at me. He said, "Who are you?" I said, "Well, I just got here." He said, "You didn't come in and register." I said, "No, I didn't register." He said, "If you work here, you got to register to get your pay." I said, "I'm happy to be here for having a cookie." You know, this guy getting wild, madder and madder at me. Eh? He said, "None of your pertinence. Are you going to be up to their register?" He's a big Scottish guy. And, of course, the devil's making me do this.
Yeah.
Eh? And in here come the superintendent and the head of Dawson Construction. In Hi Herb, and we're talking there. And you know that guy, he always disliked me.
Ever since then?
Yeah, because I was not giving him the respect he felt his position had.
I'll be darned.
But here we are. We're people doing our job.
Yeah.
To get something done that needed to be done.
Yeah. Huh.
So you're not only swimming, but you're in a...
Yeah.
And who could ask for more, eh?
Yeah. So did that grizzly bear that stood up,
actually, you know, the interesting thing of that is that, of course, I went back, and I went up there, and I looked the area over pretty good with the binoculars and couldn't see fresh signs, so I went down. There was a part of a moose carcass down there about 15 feet that bear was feeding on it. And then, and that was where he was working and being caught in the slide. Eh?
Wow.
Interesting, you know.
Yeah, that would be really, I mean, you have so many stories like that.
Well, that's how it was.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and up there at this, when you look at Mount Robson from the highway and you see that big valley up there, eh?
Yeah.
In there, periodic, there'll be a slide that comes down.
Yeah.
And most of the time they stop at the bottom. One winter of heavy snow, that mountain went virtually from the top to the bottom and come out through the timber, which was probably 3/4 of a mile, it blew down the timber, and the timber that wasn't blown down was broken and came back on itself.
Wow.
And a lot of these were at different lengths where they broke off. And lots of this stuff was probably 30-inch, 40-inch cedar. Those trees were over 200 years. So I've been over 200 years since there's any kind of an occurrence like that.
Right.
And three of us spent days there cutting out the trails. When we got finished, there's places that looked like we're cutting firewood because there's so much wood piled up along the trail.
Yeah. Did you have many slide activities in the Babine Mountains and goat?
I've flown in there. Well, actually, when I took over, I was involved. We went and counted the amount of goats in the mountain before we opened the hunting season.
Oh, okay.
You know, it was closed
yeah.
for quite a while. And so we counted the goats with a succession of flights. And in that area, there's a very conservative quota that's allowed for hunting during illegal time. It actually occurs that probably nobody even knows that it goes on, you know?
Yeah. I've been up in Hunter Basin when hunters have come down with a bag with stuff in it, you know?
Yeah.
It not Hunter Basin, I mean Victoria Basin.
But, you know, all those places have their uses and they're complex in some ways because the uses are so diversified that one kind of feels the other interferes with himself, eh?
Yeah.
And, you know, within that, there was a deal that there's so much pressure over the snowmobiling that we decided to say, okay, that area over there, you can use it, that area you can't.
Yeah.
And of course, once in a while, there might be one here, but that's a legal thing, hey?
Yeah, that's right.
And so over the years, it's worked out pretty good. But one thing I don't believe in is any kind of shelter should be in the area that is... open for the public.
Okay, like the Joe Horsa Cabin?
I don't believe in that for the simple business is this. If you go for more than a hike, a sort of a day hike, you should have certain items with
you. That's true.
That you can get by if there's an emergency. If you've got somebody with a broken leg, you can keep them warm. You can do something while you get help. But in the wintertime, to go into the same area, you should be equipped to survive the night in that area.
Right.
But if you're going to go in and I'm going to go to so-and-so cabin and you don't get there, what do you do?
Yeah, absolutely.
I tell you, I got a word. I went up and somebody had vandalized a trap box that I had hidden along the trail.
This is, yeah, okay.
A fire had been built near there.
Yeah.
And some beer bottles and stuff. And, you know, it's trap's gone. I think, well, you know, vandalism.
Yeah.
Actually, it wasn't too bad up there, but there's some. Anyway, the... after a while, I got word that a fella had a trap of mine, and he would long to talk to me. So I got him on the phone. He's at Burns Lake. Yeah, he said, I've got a trap. He said we were going into the mountain. It wasn't that far, and we got lost, and it's dark. He said, we're hunting around. I found your trap box. We chopped it all up and used it for kindling to get a fire. He said, I think you saved our lives.
Wow.
And it was about 900 yards up past the upper bridge, eh?
Up Driftwood?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
You know. Who could believe things like that?
Yeah. So and were they out skiing or what were they doing?
No, they're going into the cabin.
Oh, to the Joe Horsa Cabin?
Yeah.
Wow. When? What time of the year?
Middle of winter, trapping.
Right. Wow.
Walking on the snowmobile trail.
Wow. Yeah. And then they went out. They must have just got out.
They spent the night there beside the fire.
Interesting.
I think that maybe their enthusiasm was a lot because of the amount of beer cans that were there.
Oh, I'll be darned. Well. Yeah.
And, you know, everywhere I've, I never got into any kerfuffle over negligence or not doing the work or getting it done.
Yeah. How about parks now? Do you still keep in touch with the?
Not really.
No. Okay.
No, it's a. I think it's this business that would. Within the organization, there's a few people that I still have in contact with. Matter of fact, on May 8th every year, I phone Tom Moore, Dudley, and Alvin Hutchison. We all started work on that morning.
Oh, okay.
May 8th, 1950, in Manning Park.
Wow.
And when I'm sitting at the table with this food everywhere, scoffing down the grub, in come this little guy and sat down beside me, and he just reeked of horse manure. Oh, I could hardly stand him. And you know, I was raised around horses.
Yeah.
And there he is. He's virtually the same age as I am, We were 17, I think, then.
Yeah.
Maybe not 17, coming 17. Anyway, he became the second superintendent of Manning Park.
Oh, be darned.
I became the third superintendent of Manning Park over the years.
And you?
Years.
Yeah.
Both had left school without completing it.
Yeah.
Both of us are hardworking guys.
Exactly.
And when you think about the hundreds of people who have worked and been in the system and these guys come out of it, it's back to that deal that they've got qualities that the organization needs.
Yeah. Especially in the park system, too. That's
Such
specific.
A variety.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it shows that, like with your bibliography too, that you were raised to respect hard work and getting things ready for the day, and it's good. Said your mom was a happy person, and we all were involved in helping and having fun.
It was, I felt that. You had rules that you worked to.
Yeah.
And I got myself in a few jackpots. But lots of times I was innocent. Like the time I was down at the bridge and the guys were there. It was in wartime. And they got those big blue matches. Remember the ones?
Yeah.
Eddie matches?
Yeah.
That light, lick them all in. And then light them and throw them, and down they'd go. There'd be a smoke all the way down. They're talking, this German airplanes have been shot down, and that was what during the war. God, I was really interested. Never seen anything. Went home, got a few of the matches, went out to the pit toilet. Good thing it wasn't in the barn. And I'm licking these and dropping them in there. Oh, boy. And, Mum had got, and Cece had got some packages of that wrapping that was around peaches and stuff on the high grade. This was reserved exclusively for the girls. And, of course, we had rougher things there. Somehow a fire got started in there. Pretty soon there's a fire coming up. Small part of it. Holy jeez, excitement. I'm running around there trying to get the water, and pretty quick the neighbors are there, people running and laughing, and others going, and they got it out before anything got burnt down.
Yeah.
But there were several people around, and I was treated badly. I was given a good licking, And I always felt that was unfair. Because it wasn't me that lit those fires. It was those crashing German airplanes.
How old were you?
I know I shouldn't have had.
Yeah. Old enough to know better.
I tell you, I think my mom had some laughter over that.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But well, of course, they wouldn't allow me to know that.
Yeah. Well, Herb, I thank you so much. It was really kind of you to give up so much of your morning, too.
Well, I need to get out a bit, you know.
Yeah.
The life has changed quite a bit.
Yes, it has.
And we do what we have to do.
Yeah. I'm going to get your picture, if you don't mind, before we go.
Yeah.
So this is Herb Green at the Old Church on King Street, March 15th, and Sonia Lester, and we're signing off. Have a good day, Herb, and I'll get your photo.